I am Platt on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Matt Rader joins me again. The award-winning poet and educator has a new collection out, Fine. It's a collection that is largely set in the Kelowna area of British Columbia's Okanagan Valley, and it's set in recent times over the summer of 2021 to June of 2022. It's a time of the ongoing pandemic. There was the heat dome of June 2021, the atmospheric river of November 2021, the announcement of hundreds of unmarked residential school graves across Canada, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and more. I'll ask Matt about the existential dread that seems to follow poems in this collection. I'll ask about what the future might look like and whether there might be hope for us, the planet, and even within Matt's own sense of the present. There are poems in this collection that grapple with questions of disability, illness, trans identity, and healing, as well as Matt's remarkable gift at looking closely at the world just outside our door. As he evokes the Okanagan Valley in poems in this collection, you feel as though you're there, even if you've never been there, with the attentive wonderment that Matt displays in his work and life. Matt Rader is the author of 6 volumes of poetry, a collection of short stories, and a book of nonfiction. His previous book, Ghost Hawk, was shortlisted for the Dorothy Livesey Poetry Prize. He teaches creative writing at the University of British Columbia, Okanagan, where he joined me from 3 weeks ago. This new collection is from Knightwood Editions. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Matt Rader. Professor Rader, good morning.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. You know, I was thinking back to our previous conversations, and I've always liked talking to you, even from the first time we talked. And then I remembered, as I was preparing my notes for today, that you once lived near my old high school.
Oh, yeah?
I went to Tupper Secondary at... for people in Vancouver, it's King Edward between Fraser and Main. And I don't know, I've always felt an affinity towards you because of that. I don't know. did you grow up in Vancouver, or was that because you were going to UBC?
No. Well, my mom and her family were from Vancouver, and my mom grew up at 43rd and Granville, so I spent a lot of time in Vancouver as a kid. And then... after university, I lived in Vancouver off and on for 10 years, and we did live for a time at King Ed and Fraser, yeah. So right in that neighborhood.
Yeah, so I know, it's weird how these things, you remember these things
as you're
preparing your notes for an interview. As I was reading Fine, I had this feeling of uncertainty, and I don't know if it's just me, but I guess we all feel that the way that the world is around us. Of which you are obviously a keen observer, this feeling of uncertainty, this feeling of say a lack of optimism, is this something that you're feeling that you're quite aware of? Say,
I think I'd probably be lying to say that I wasn't aware of it.
Yeah.
I tried to write a book that wasn't pessimistic. I'm reminded of this poem by Philip Larkin about, I think it's called Talking in Bed, and at the end of the poem he says, it becomes harder and harder to find something to say that's true and kind, or at least not untrue and not unkind. And there is an element of that where I don't want to be like a Pollyanna kind of optimist that's not facing reality.
Yeah.
But I also don't want to be a pessimist, and I think, weirdly, the uncertainty gives me something kind of like hope, because in the uncertainty includes this feeling that we don't know which way it's going to go, and it's probably going to go badly and well, and, you know, we're going to have pain and joy, and maybe in that uncertainty is a kind of equanimity.
Yeah, because the book is not without, this collection, I should say, is not without hope. You do feel hopeful about a lot of things, don't you?
I try, and if not hopeful, at least like I think I do feel hopeful. I do think that there is a future, and I do think that future includes joy and good feelings and lots of interesting things that we haven't even dreamed up yet.
I guess that to understand joy and good feeling, we have to understand what's bad, say. And there is a lot of that that's around us, isn't there?
Yeah, I think, you know, in my previous two books, I spent a lot of time trying to think about how to live in my own body, how to you know from a previous conversation that as somebody who lived with chronic illness most of my life, and also I had moved to a new place in the Okanagan about 10 years ago, and so I was really trying to learn how to live in the body of the Okanagan and in my own body. And at the end of like that process, publishing Visual Inspection and then Ghost Talk, I really wanted to look at what was around me in the social world and trying to respond to how do we live through these kinds of cataclysms and this kind of this sense of despair that is easy to experience these days. I think that all of the many things that seem like insurmountable problems in front of us, they feel similar to me to living in a body in pain. And one way that you live with pain is to accept it.
Now, in accepting it, does that perhaps signal that we give in to some sort of powerlessness? Because as I'm reading the collection, you know, you talk about these various things that are happening around you and the sort, and so you do feel, as a reader, an existential dread, say. But at the same time, when you're writing about this, do you write from a place of powerlessness?
Define powerlessness.
Well, you know, if it's warm in the room where you're sitting or where I'm sitting, we could easily go over and turn down the thermostat or open a window. With climate change, we can't really do things like that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Although I don't know that I would use the term powerlessness exactly. It's something more like a recognition of how things always were. You never really could do anything about the sun. You know, you never really could do anything about the wind. It was all going to happen anyway. And there's a kind of like, it's not powerlessness in the sense of political power or the possibility of affecting your own life or changing any circumstances that you have, but it's something more like a powerlessness that comes from the recognition that you were always connected, you were always part of one thing that was bigger than you. And, you know, in some ways we could talk like life on this planet. We are part of that. We are part of the life on the planet. We can only affect so much within our own selves. And that's not it's not powerlessness in the sense of despair. It's, like I say, something more like acceptance, more like seeing what's around you for what it is. And that can be I found it quite healing and moving.
And it must be humbling, too.
Oh, it's extremely humbling. One has to, I think, at least in my adult life, it's been a process of kind of unmaking myself.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like. Or another way to look at it is to recognizing oneself in the lake, or oneself in the moon, oneself in the trees growing around you. And so relocating your own, what feels like your own, into a place that's no longer really just yours.
Yeah, that sense of humbling, I should say. I got that in the poems where you talk about nature and the world around you. You know, it's been said about you that your senses are sharp, and they are as sharp as ever in this collection. Fine, whether it's your sense of smell, say, or sense of sight when you're looking at the world around you, nature especially, the feel as well, the touch of what's happening outside. Has that always been the case for you? I mean, have you always been a keen observer, say, of the outdoors even?
I don't know. I think it's a thing I've been practicing. One thing about your senses or one senses is that the more you pay attention to something, the more aware you are of what you're not catching, you know? And to look at any object, for example, is to be aware of the part of the object you can't see. And I think that, you know, sometimes people have wanted to say I'm a nature poet, which is not a thing I would really think about, but I do feel like when I look out my window, the biggest things I see, even though I'm talking to you from UBC Okanagan right now, and out my office window are two big ponderosa pines, and behind them are the edge of the foothills of the Monashies, and beyond that is the sky, and those are the biggest things outside my window. So it sort of feels funny to me to imagine that seeing literally the largest thing in front of you would be a kind of keen observation. So I don't know that this is something that I've always done. In fact, I'm acutely aware, and I'm reminded of it over and over again, how many blind spots I have. Like I said about the sort of process of unbecoming the self, it's related to a process of seeing more. And I'm using seeing to stand in for all of the senses, but for perceiving more about the world.
Yeah, we lose sight of a lot of these things, don't we, as we go about our daily life, things that we should pay attention to.
Yeah, I think this is a conversation I was having this morning with some students about dancing, actually. You know, that dancing begins with a disruption of your habitual movements in space. But those things have to become habits. Those new disruptions, they become part of the habit in order for you to do the next level of performance. You know, anybody who plays an instrument knows that not long after some proficiency enters your playing, you have to actually not think about things in order to be able to play the instrument at that level. You think about new things, and I think from my perspective, one function of art is that kind of disruption of the things that we see that become habitual because that's a necessary part of operating our lives and living our lives. We can't really, if we were aware of every single thing going on around us all the time, it would be overwhelming.
Yeah.
And we would cease to be able to function in these extremely sophisticated ways that we are able to function. And one thing that art does is disrupt those habitual things and create the possibilities of new habit making.
Yeah, I mean, I can't help but think that someone will pick up fine and find a new way to look at something that they've been thinking about or seeing or experiencing for a while now. And I guess you reach that point, too, as you're writing a particular poem. Otherwise, you wouldn't write it, would you?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, that's a very good comment. It's something that I say to my students all the time, that if you don't know something, you didn't, at the end of writing the poem, if you don't know something new, you didn't really do it right.
Yeah.
There's really, at least for myself, writing poems is very much about coming to a new kind of knowledge or awareness or something that I, seeing things differently than I did before. That's what writing poems is pretty much about for me.
So when you look back at this collection, Fine, as well as your previous collections, and you look back at them today, can you track personal growth?
I think so. I hope so. Yeah. I mean, one's a sense of growth may be relative or but at the very least, I can see change. And I can see lots of change over the years. My first book came out, it arrived at my door on my 27th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to launch Fine the day before my 46th birthday. And my eldest kid was born the same year that first book came out, and they're now in second year at university. And I feel like something between that first book and this latest book is something like a whole childhood and adolescence, and you know, this whole period of becoming a different person, really. Like at 46, I feel very different than I did at 27. And in the books, I hope it's there. I think it's there, but that's probably for other people to decide.
Yeah, it's certainly more than just aging, I guess, right?
It is, but it's also funny. Like, I think aging is like we want to talk about growing up and wisdom and all those sorts of things. And I think that that's true. And I think there are different forms of growing up. And I hope that's in there too. I also think there is something about endurance and duration, and that is simply its own thing. That, like, there is something about how if you've been alive for 70 years, you just see things that somebody who's been alive for 46 years won't see. And I think that you can be, like, I think it's possible to be 70 and not mature in certain ways.
Absolutely,
but,
yeah.
But nevertheless, that time still has an impact.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we overlook the fact that endurance and longevity and tenure even matter or mean something.
I think they really do. Yeah. I think they really do. I mean, that's my sense. My sense is even, let's say, even the least wise amongst the our elders know things that we can't know.
Exactly. Yeah. A number of poems in this collection contend with how technology has affected our lives. Our eyes. How our eyes connect to certain things, or how we see certain things differently now than we did, say, 30 years ago, if possible. Our brains, I guess, have been rewired in a sense. You know, I do a lot of complaining on Twitter and Facebook, and one of the things that I'm adamant about is when I write the date, I put the day, the month, and the year.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm a little precious about it, I'll put the day of the week in front of all that. So I mentioned that one day, and someone said it should actually be year, month, date. And rather than get into an argument, as we're all prone to do on social media, it made me think about how the computer has made that person think that way.
Mm.
And so you contend with that in a number of poems in this collection. But how we've changed because of technology, the computer especially.
I think this you're totally right. This collection does address that, and I think it's related to my comment earlier about habit, that technologies are always part of our habitual life. Like, they spring up around organized activity. That's what makes it a tool. And at some point, I was aware that despite the presence of digital technologies in my life, they were not appearing in my poems.
Mm-hmm.
Or not appearing in any significant way. And I had just said, like, you know, a few minutes ago, that when I look out the window, I want to write about the literally biggest things in front of me, and it seemed kind of nuts to me that somehow it had, evaded my, if not my, like, awareness, my, like, sense that those sorts of perceptions and language around digital technology in particular, whether that they belonged in poems. Like, maybe I had a sense that they didn't. In this collection, I think I started to try and engage with some of the language. That was where it began, with some of the thinking about the language of the digital world.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like, disturbing it so I could see the habit of it, and see, like, more, like, making even, like, the return enter key on your keyboard more metaphorical. And begin to consider, like, I didn't put it in my in the collection, but I often thought about the shift key, and I thought it was, like, such an interesting idea. There you have this thing that shifts the meaning, and then you could just press a key, and then that would a character would change based on that that key.
Yeah.
And we call it shift, and we call it enter, and we call, you know, these are, and there are all these metaphors that are embedded into this digital world, and I wanted to start thinking about that, and I think it was related to this idea that I wanted to talk to the people around me, to the social world. If I had been trying to live in my own body in this valley, the body of the valley, what did it mean to live in the, like, body politic? What did it mean to, like, talk to my neighbors in language and then about things that would be at least familiar on some level?
Yeah, you talk that poem. I quite like that poem, Return Enter. You talk about double spacing the trees that we see, actually, it's not in that poem. The other one I was saying, there's a beautiful line in I think it's called Doxa, where you talk about being in a field and you dox the meadow with your phone because you wanted to know what the names of the plants were.
Yeah.
and that's such a a new language has emerged because of the internet, because of the computer. In the last 20, 25 years, that certain words have popped up and have taken on new meaning as well, haven't they?
Yeah, it's a whole new world, and sometimes they're invisible to us, because they're so we're so used to them,
right?
And they become so invisible so quickly that in that poem Doxa, I was really thinking about what counted as intelligence. Artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
What was natural intelligence, and how there are these different layers. Like, there's the layer of the field as it appears in the screen of your phone, but then there's your own sensory perception of the field, and that itself is a kind of like composite thing. It's made up of what's possible with your own body, and where. Which was the illusion, and what way are those things kind of entangled with each other?
It was a beautiful poem in that section of the book called Resolution, which itself has a meaning that we're used to and that we probably think of right off the top of our heads when we say that word.
Mm-hmm.
But it has another meaning, doesn't it, when we're thinking of the screens that we're looking at, or the screens on our phone, say, even.
Yeah, and I was definitely thinking about that in writing this poem. I was thinking about how close one can, like, what degree of information we might have in any one moment, what we would miss, and how we... there's also this sense of resolving oneself around, or resolving, making a resolution towards an orientation, with the understanding that no amount of resolution is going to capture the whole image,
or the end, even, right?
Yeah. Nothing is going to be captured completely, and so one has to contend with that. And in that sense, those are questions that I do remember, even from my very first collection. I remember I had a friend who died in a way that was indeterminate, like what happened.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, like actively going, deciding, okay, I'm going to have to decide how to feel about this because I'm not going to know what happened. And that sort of sense of relating to that kind of an uncertainty has grown, and I think... is in this book in a new, more, hopefully, maybe more mature way.
I've reached you at school where you teach. Do you teach full time, Matt?
I do, yeah.
How do you find the time to write then?
Some years are easier than others.
Yeah.
I wrote most of this on my sabbatical, my first leave, so. That obviously helped quite a bit, and otherwise I have this like weird experience. I think other people must experience it too, but my experience of myself is that I don't ever write. Mm. And my and I think that obviously this is untrue, but I think it's partly because I lose time. Like, writing is a different, like, it's almost a different, entering a different state of mind. And so I can be kind of weirdly ruthless about my time when I need to write. Like, it used to be when I was younger, my family would get annoyed because I would get up and just walk away from a meal.
Yeah.
Or like, and it's almost like I enter some kind of fugue state. And really, when the question is less about making time to write and more like making the space to prepare to write, that's actually harder. Finding some quiet time or some time in which my day isn't filled up with a whole bunch of other things. You know, John Ashbery said you have to waste a lot of time to be a poet, and that kind of like time wasting is really the hardest, the biggest challenge, because once the beginning of the poem comes, it's like that's what I do, and that's how the poem, that's how I find the time.
Well, what was your relationship to poetry growing up? Did you enjoy it? Because a lot of us who went to school and studied English, say, even in elementary school, didn't like poetry. And I'm wondering, were you the same? And how do you evolve to that point where you decide, well, I want to be a poet myself?
I think it's a bit of, I mean, everybody has their own path. In my case, I grew up, my mom always read me Dennis Lee, like Alligator Pie and
right.
those sort of poems.
Yeah.
And even Dennis Lee came to the Comox Valley where I grew up one time, and I was a little kid, and he bounced me on his knee, and I ran away crying. I remembered this like thing, and I think I had the luck, like I had a teacher who read us Shel Silverstein, and I remember drawing the bear in the frigid air and really liking the drawing. And sometimes I think those weird connections, even like the Dennis Lee one where it disturbed me, it also connected me somehow to poems. And in high school, I had a English lit teacher in grade 12 who was really good, and he got us, gave us a big piece of paper and told us to draw Kubla Khan by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and I think even then, I wouldn't have said I loved poems. I went to university. I took a creative writing class. My first class was with Patrick Lane, and I thought Patrick was just really interesting because he said things like, "I'm never going to teach first year again," and these sorts of. He was hard on us, but he was gruff, and he reminded me of my dad, and that was something. And then I thought I might be a novelist, I thought I might be an illustrator, I thought I might try social work, but I kept taking creative writing classes. I took a couple of classes with Lorna Crozier.
Yeah.
And somehow it just kept staying with me, poems and poems, like the idea of writing poems. The idea of working on language at that level. My grandfather was always, my mom's dad was always a storyteller, and he always would tell us stories before bed. And my dad, who was a long-haul trucker, he would read me stories. Sometimes I'd go with him on trips, and he would read to me in the truck stops. So I had this sense of story and literature in my life. And I think that like those things all made the poetry a possibility, I guess. They were like primers for poems. And it wasn't until I graduated university that I thought, I should really try writing poems seriously and reading poems seriously. And then I embarked on a process of trying to make myself like poems. And it was weirdly deliberate. And over time, I came to love poems and see the world through poems. So that's a bit of a long and not very like concise answer to this question, but I think it's a bit mysterious.
Yeah, and it's worked, hasn't it?
It's worked. It's somehow given me a life.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned, and this is a shout out to all the marvelous teachers out there. You were told to draw a poem that you were hearing.
Yeah,
that never happened to me, and I can only imagine just how beneficial that is to a young person to engage with a poem that way.
I think this early experience of drawing Shel Silverstein and then later drawing Kubla Khan, they opened up a way to meet poetry that wasn't about analyzing it.
Yeah.
It wasn't about like what I could say that hadn't been said or getting the right idea, but rather like an affective response to the poem, and endless possibility that the poem could be anything. It could be a drawing, I agree that was a lucky break for me.
I can't see how it would work in high school, though, because I can just remember how self-conscious we all were about our drawings, especially when there were people in class who were much better drawers than the rest of us. We wouldn't want to show whatever we were sketching or doodling, right?
Well, in that class, we were another lucky break was it was maybe like 10 students.
Yeah.
And so we got to know each other. We sat in the round. We sat like literally had a round table, and we sat all around it, and Mr. Thompson was our teacher, and when we did the drawing, we had one big piece of paper, and we drew it together. And so, in a way, it wasn't like I made my drawing and then showed it to you. We were all kind of building off of each other's marks on the page, and it was even like talking through like what should be on the page, you know, what kinds of things do we want to represent. Those are really like creative interventions into a poem or to an encounter with a poem. And maybe we were just lucky that that group of students was able to do that. I think that's another kind of stroke of luck.
Yeah. Matt, it's been such a pleasure talking to you again. This is I was going to invoke the title, so it's a fine collection. It is called Fine, and it is a very good collection of poems, and very worthwhile reading on my part, because I it made me think a lot about the things that are around me and things that I should look at differently as a result. I so appreciate your time today. Thanks for this, and all the best.
Thank you very much.
The book is called Fine. It's published by Knightwood Editions. Its author, Matt Rader, joined me on the line from Kelowna in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.